I'll steal something from Joe Lees. He said, if you don't get a good aim on this, it's like a spittoon.
Thank you, Roger.
Thank you very much. That was good. My name is Arbutus O'Neill, and it is by the grace of God that I belong to the Al-Anon family groups. I am powerless over people, over places, and over things. And because of this program, I can make this admission this afternoon without feeling guilty. My life continues to be unmanageable when I fail to practice the principles that were given to us by a bunch of ex-drunks who found sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I like to believe that the families of the early members of Alcoholics Anonymous were convinced by the miracle of sobriety that this program would work for everyone. And it was out of this conviction that the Al-Anon family groups grew to reach all over the world and have shown astounding results. We subscribe to the concept that alcoholism is a family illness. And then we get so carried away telling people how sick we got that we forget to say, we have a program for family recovery. Ours is a fellowship that shares. But please, let us share our recovery, not our sickness. And I'm just delighted to be here. I like the theme of your convention. And I bring you greetings from my Bill. He doesn't travel with me anymore. Bill is pretty frail now. But someone asked him recently if he minded me wandering around over the country without him. And he said, no. He's perfectly comfortable because I'm here today. He knows that you will take good care of me, and you have. He knows that you'll take good care of me, and he expects you to. And I'll go home and report that I received most loving attention. And I'm particularly grateful because the Manitoba Assembly members are here. Now, that's beyond the call of duty, and I'm delighted that you're here. That's what this weekend is all about. I've heard several of you say, I haven't seen you since last year. And I think this is remarkable. I think it's very difficult for us to see growth within ourselves, but we can see it in other people. Regrettably, we can also see regression. And these AA people just delight me. They're always so glad to see each other. They're just delighted to see each other, especially these big things, you know, the internationals, and they charge across the room and beat each other on the back. Just so glad to see you. And then somebody else comes in the back door back there, and they stop right in the middle of a sentence, and they say, oh, look, there's old George, and he's still sober. They don't even expect each other to stay sober. Love without expectancy, it's called. And I, as I say, I'm delighted to be here. I wasn't particularly happy with the weather we had last night when we were coming up from Winnipeg, but I think that the driver knew what he was doing, and so I didn't bother to tell him how to drive. And that's progress for me. I'm called a long-timer in the Al-Anon family groups, and that isn't very important until you become a long-timer. And I'll give you the formula. You just keep coming to meetings and stay alive, and you'll make it. And it has been my privilege to talk to a lot of people in a lot of places. And I've learned about people. People are all alike. Every one of you who are here today are here for exactly the same reason that I'm here. We were driven here under the cruel lash of alcoholism because we had nowhere else to go. Nowhere else to go. And I once thought that alcoholism was a product of my generation, but this isn't true. Alcoholism is as old as time. Alcoholism is an insidious, progressive disease that prompts the unthinking to make jokes about drunks, but it can leave a family homeless and penniless. Alcoholism is a public cancer that can turn a man or a woman against themselves. Alcoholism is a blight on the history of mankind. The Bible warns against it. Shakespeare diagnosed it. Tennessee Williams built a prize-winning play around it. But no one, as far as I have been able to learn, seemed to do anything about alcoholism until the advent of AA. Priests and ministers were baffled at their inability to cope with this insidious habit, this dreadful malady, if you please. They preached to alcoholics. They prayed over you. They had you sign pledges. And when these things failed, they damned your soul to hell. Men of science, before the advent of AA, wanted to find a cure for alcoholism. They wanted to find a pill or a vaccine that would stop compulsive drinking. And failing to do this, they said to the medical students, "Don't waste your time on these people. They're hopeless." Preachment failed, and there was no cure. So there was only one other thing they knew to do with alcoholics. You must be punished. So we locked you up in jail. The more you drank, the longer we kept you in jail. And the longer we kept you in jail, the drunker you got when we released you. It became a vicious cycle. We tried to change the body chemistry of sick people with punishment, and society allowed this to happen. Nay, we insisted on it to our everlasting shame. I'm quite sure that we'll never know how many sick alcoholics died in the jails around our country at the hands of sadistic jailers. We'll never know. But there was one group of people who never gave up on the alcoholics. These were the families of alcoholics, the people who loved you. We took jobs to feed the children that you were too sick to be responsible for. We doctored your hangovers. Some of us bought your liquor. We picked up your hot checks. We bailed you out of jails. We pled with judges. We said John's a good man when he's sober. And to complete this ridiculous paradox, we gave you hell every time you got drunk. And society was puzzled at the behavior of the families of alcoholics. Thank you. They could understand alcoholics when they wrecked their cars, wore lampshades on their head at parties. But they couldn't understand the families of alcoholics. They could not understand why we continued to love and care for the alcoholics. There were some people, of course, that thought we were endowed with some special quality that made us better than other people. They were the ones that gave us the halos to wear. And we accepted them quite willingly. I put mine on every morning when I put on my lipstick. And my halo had a name. It was called self-righteousness. Did you ever notice that word don't taste good? These people almost killed us with pity. And we don't need pity. We need understanding. There were other people, of course, that thought we were just plain fools to live under such circumstances. My mother came in this group. Mother used to say, "God looks after fools and drunks, and that takes care of our abuse and bill." And Mother was right. God did look after us when we didn't have sense enough to look after ourselves. And then a little farther down the road, the professionals got interested in us. I try never to leave out the professionals, and I try to remember what Bill Wilson said, that we should be friendly with our friends and their professions, but it gets awfully hard sometimes. But these are the ones that put the labels on us. They were the ones that called us aggravating influences, disturbing factors. And then they got real corny and they called us suffering Susie, wavering Winifred, and on and on and on. And so I decided, since the researchers were so busy in getting data on us, that I'd do a little research on my part. And I learned that Alexander the Great was an alcoholic. He'd conquered the whole known civilized world when he was 33 years old. And he wept because there were no more worlds to conquer. But he couldn't conquer his desire to drink, and he died prematurely in an alcoholic convulsion. I learned that Robert Louis Stevenson was an alcoholic. He gave the world its most beautiful folk music, but he was a compulsive drinker. It seemed to come on him like a sickness, his wife once said, and so it does. Stephen Foster died on the New York Bowery, and when he was dead, they found in his pockets 38 cents. One penny for each year of a misspent life, and the lyrics to another song. Stephen Foster loved his wife, his Jeannie with the light brown hair, but the love of his wife couldn't keep him sober, and he died drunk. Robert Louis Stevenson was an alcoholic. He could weave the magic of children's stories, and he all but destroyed himself with the magic that he found in a bottle. It could have been a fifth of gin or a quart of bourbon. And he describes the personality change of an alcoholic in the story, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And I watched this personality change right in my own living room, like a lot of you did. You saw the bottle change the man you love into a babbling idiot, into a degenerate animal, into a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. History said very little about the families of these men and others like them, but I believe that I know the fear and the loneliness that Jeannie knew when she waited for her restless, talented husband to come home from a spree. And I believe that I know the homesickness that Fanny Stevenson knew when she waited for her husband, when she left her home in California to go to a South Sea island with her husband in hopes that he might regain his health. Robert Louis Stevenson had a dual problem. He also had tuberculosis. And I believe with all my heart that I know the joy that they knew when he did find sobriety. And I believe that I know the serenity to some degree that they both knew when he found sobriety. As I say, history says very little about these men and others like them. And my home group gives me a hard time. They said, why on earth do you feel it's necessary, Arbus, that you get access to a microphone, that you give people a history lesson? Well, I have a reason, of course. I can't tell jokes. I always forget the punchline. No, that isn't true. What I'm trying to do is give you some idea about what it was like then and what they're doing now. These very same people that were so baffled at their inability to do anything about alcoholism are doing a great deal about it right now. Priests and ministers now feel that alcoholics are God's children too, and they send them to AA to get help. And they send their families to us so they can get well, too. It's now possible to get an alcoholic in a hospital with a simple diagnosis of alcoholism. This was not always true. When Bill hit bottom, you couldn't get an alcoholic in the hospital unless the doctor was willing to compromise his license and make a false diagnosis. He just couldn't do it. And we have marvelous facilities in our federal penitentiaries all over the country under the auspices of AA for the people who are in those institutions. And these people are doing a great deal about alcoholism. National Council on Alcoholism has done a yeoman's job on teaching the public that alcoholism is an illness, a treatable illness, and that alcoholics need help and that they deserve it. But in spite of all of these efforts that are being made, it's almost impossible anymore to pick up a magazine or a newspaper and not find an article about alcoholism. It's become the end thing to have an alcoholic in your home. Now, if you don't have one, I suggest that you go out and get one. They're the handiest things you can have. They're as handy as a pocket on a shirt. Anything that goes wrong, it's their fault. Now, don't marry them. Just borrow them. But in spite of all the efforts that the professionals are making, and please don't misunderstand me, I have tremendous respect for these people, for their good intentions and for their training. But they're not getting the job done. Had you noticed that? They're just not getting the job done. But right this minute, I'm looking at a room full of experts. Right now. You are the people who know about alcoholism because you've lived with it. You know the symptoms. You know the progression. You know about the alibi system. You know about slips in AA. There isn't very much. Some of you know about alcoholic convulsions. A few of you have lived through the terrors of DTs. There isn't very much about alcoholism that you do not know because you have lived with it. So in my opinion, this is a job for you to do, a job for you and a job for me. And I learned this a long time ago. You see, I came into this outfit before we had an outfit. As the lady told you, I came here when we had 50 groups, 50 Al-Anon groups in the whole world. 50 Al-Anon groups in the whole world. And I'll have to update that figure on the groups that we have now. I think the delegates are reporting over 40,000 groups now worldwide. And I've watched this evolution of this fellowship, and it's been the most fascinating, exciting thing in my life. I wouldn't take $1 million for it. I'll tell you something else. I wouldn't take another million to do it again. But this evolution that you all take so for granted, and you know, it gets a little embarrassing when someone introduces you at one of these things that's young enough to be your grandchild, and your only value to the fellowship is that you just lived longer than anybody else. It gets a little embarrassing. But this has been a fascinating thing for me. And I think it was Bob that did a synopsis of my talk without my permission. But I did attend my first open AA meeting in Amarillo, Texas in 1948, and I did not want to go to that meeting. I had watched my husband spend 6 years to get 1 year of sobriety, and I did not have very much confidence in my husband's sobriety. And I certainly could not see any value in associating myself with a group of people who, by their own admission, had ruined everything they'd ever touched. They stood at podiums like this and told how they had lost their businesses, how they'd lost their health, how they'd lost their family. Some of them had been in jail. And I didn't want to associate with that kind of people. The only reason that I went to that meeting was because I had put myself under an obligation to a very lovely lady who was married to a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you haven't picked up on the accent yet, I'm a hillbilly. I grew up in the hills of North Carolina, And hillbillies do not like to be obliged to anyone. And that's the only reason that I went to that meeting. And you probably noticed this weekend, and I drink a lot of coffee. And this was an open meeting, as I said. There was about 150 people there. And I'm sure I'd made a number of trips to the coffee bar. And after we were seated in the meeting, a very beautiful woman that I later learned was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous leaned across Marguerite and whispered to me. What she said was, "How long has it been since you had a drink, honey?" And I wasn't embarrassed by her question. I'm not a teetotaler. I once said I didn't trust teetotalers, but I have a friend down in Wichita Falls, Texas, that's never had a drink in her life. She's never even tasted liquor. She's a real teetotaler. And I would trust my life with Mildred, so I don't say that anymore. But Marguerite was embarrassed at the lady's question, and she answered for me. She said, "Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic. Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic, but she knows about alcoholism." I grew up in a house with two men, both of whom was my father. My father was a gray-eyed Irishman who taught me to love poetry. He taught me to sing Irish folk songs. He had the patience to teach me my geometry problems with his framing square. But on Saturday night, my dad turned into a devil. My dad was a craftsman, the likes of which we don't have anymore, and he loved to build things for my mother. I've known many times through the long winter nights back in the hills of Carolina when he'd spend all winter long building something for Mother. It might be a china closet or a coffee table. And he loved wood. I've watched Dad caress a piece of wood much the same as a lady caresses a piece of satin or a piece of velvet. And he would say of the wood as he caressed it, "This wood has a beautiful fault." And I didn't know what he was talking about until I found this program. He would select the wood very carefully, put it together with great precision as only a craftsman can do. And he would sand it and polish it and truly make of it a thing of beauty. And then he would smash it in a drunken fury. My dad's alcoholism destroyed both of my parents. My dad's alcoholism destroyed my beautiful mother. It turned her into an old, ugly, bitter woman who hated my dad. She hated him as long as she lived. She hated him long after he was dead and in his grave. And in the last years of her life, when she spent in total darkness, she hated anybody that had ever loved John Martin, and that included me. Dad hurt Mother. He hurt her physically, and he hurt her emotionally. And my mother could never understand, when her jaw was broken, that Dad had simply meant to kill a centipede that was crawling in her hair. My dad was a hallucinating drunk. He was absolutely and totally insane when he drank. And my father's alcoholism destroyed both of my parents. And after I gained the courage in this program to ask the God of my understanding for special favors, I closed every day of my life with one special prayer. "God, don't let my dad die drunk." Now, I cannot tell you why that is such a terror to those of us who love alcoholics. I cannot tell you. I can only tell you that it is. "God, don't let my dad die drunk." My father died in 1965. He had throat cancer. He did not die drunk. And when my brother Mike called me, to tell me that Dad had a terminal illness, he said to me, "We're going to have to pray extra hard for Dad Arbus. He's not going to make it." And I said, "No, No. Now, you know very well that I didn't want that filthy stuff to destroy that beautiful baritone voice. You know I didn't. You know I didn't want that filthy stuff to make it impossible for my father to even have a drink of water. You know I didn't. But I prayed, God, don't let my dad die drunk. I do not tell you these things about my dad or about my mother that you may weep for them. My dad's all right. He doesn't have to drink anymore. And mother no longer hates him. They're all right. I tell you these things that you may know that I have always loved an alcoholic. And because I love alcoholics, I want to restore their families. I know a lot about alcoholics. I believe with all my heart, I am convinced that of all things an alcoholic loves, he loves his family most. Even when you tear us down over and over and over again, you love your family most. Of this I am convinced. Father Martin says you cannot identify an alcoholic except by the one that you know. And when I met that tall Texan who's the father of my children, I was not concerned with his drinking because he didn't drink like that. Bill was not a hallucinating, insane drunk. He was a life of the party drunk. He taught debutantes to put your little foot. And he had a ball for a long time. He didn't drink like Dad, and I was not alarmed. I drank with Bill. And we got drunk. We worked for a company that sent us all over the United States. And we got drunk everywhere we went. We got drunk in Chicago, St. Louis, San Francisco, anywhere we were, we got drunk. And it was just a thing to do. In my generation, it was very important to have fun. I heard an AA lady say one time she had so much fun it like killed her. And that's just about what happened to Bill and me. But in 1940, two things happened that made Bill and me grow up. We became parents, and the world became involved in a war. And I quit drinking with Bill. Things were too serious. I was watching the troop movements in Europe and later in the South Pacific. I was watching the casualty listings because some of the people that I'd gone to school with and some members of our families were in the military service. I quit drinking with Bill. We had our second child, and Bill was not there when Nancy was born. Nancy came on Wednesday, but she didn't meet her dad till next Sunday. And when Bill came to the hospital with the usual paraphernalia that you men bring to us when we have your babies, he caused a great deal of confusion in the Catholic hospital where we had our second child. He wanted to teach the Catholic nun who was in charge of the maternity ward that Texas stomp and the good sister didn't want to dance. And when he left the hospital with the help of two big burly orderlies, he sat down on the streetcar track in full view of my window, forced the motorman to stop so he could tell him about our baby girl. You see, Bill was still having fun with his drinking. And our only son came the next year. And this time the trip to the delivery room was a little bit different. Something went wrong. And they needed Bill. And they couldn't find Bill. Now, had I been able to talk to them, I could have told them to look in a bar. But you see, I didn't know which one. And my friends in AA tell me there is no loneliness in the world as great as that of the alcoholic who has run out of time. But I believe I know about loneliness. The loneliness of an alcoholic's wife when she goes to a delivery room with the full knowledge that a compulsion to drink is depriving her of her husband's devotion. This, I believe, is loneliness. The lonely task of keeping the spirit of Christmas alive for small children whose father has forgotten what day it is. This, I believe, is loneliness. And the crawling fingers of loneliness that you feel when you wait by the hospital bed of an injured child who cries for her father, and you can't find her father. I want my daddy. And you can't find her daddy. This, I believe, is loneliness. Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic, but she knows about alcoholism. And I want you to know that when I came to the state of Texas, 1944, I had never heard the term alcoholism in reference to my young husband's drinking. Not one single time had I ever heard that reference. And I watched this boy lose everything he had that he wanted to keep. And I couldn't help him. My Bill lost his left eye in a drunken accident, and he could not stop drinking. My Bill lost his left arm in a drunken accident, and he could not stop drinking. I watched him lose the respect of the people he worked for, the affection of his family, and finally his own self-respect. And the most painful experience that I had in those days when Bill himself looked up at me and said, "Why don't you take the children and leave, honey? I'm no damn good." He lost everything that he had that he wanted to keep. And I couldn't help him. And I wanted to. With every fiber of my being, I wanted to help Bill. And I couldn't help Bill. And I'm going to say something to you AA people, and please don't misunderstand me. I would never want to say anything from this or any other podium that would hurt you. You've been hurt enough. But I've heard you stand at podiums like this and say, "A non-alcoholic don't know what they're talking about." And I want you to know that I know what I'm talking about. I wanted to help Bill. We wanted to help you, but we couldn't help you because you would not let us. It seemed to me that you put us on the other side of a thick glass wall, and we could see you, and we could hear you. We are not calloused people. We are not. We know the mental torture you experience. We know the physical misery. We wanted to help you, but we couldn't help you because we couldn't get through to you. It's the feeling, and I think those of you who are parents will recognize this, it's the feeling you have when you tend a sick child. The child hurts, is burning up with fever, and it cries, and you want to help the baby, but you can't help the baby because the baby can't tell you where it hurts. And you couldn't tell us where you hurt. And we couldn't help you, but dear God, we wanted to. And I want you to remember that the next time you make a funny about a member of the Al-Anon family groups. Remember that. We wanted to help you, but we couldn't help you because you couldn't tell us where you hurt. There's some of you here who wouldn't be here now if it wasn't for somebody like me. And please remember that when you criticize the Al-Anon family groups. And it was because of this unholy compulsion that gripped my husband that we started on what I refer to as a new kind of education. And in the pursuit of this education, we met some people. The first people we met, of course, were the AA members. And I never shall forget the first AA member that ever talked to me. He came to my house in the middle of the afternoon, and he described to me what I referred to then as this rehabilitation program for alcoholics. I didn't know anything else to call it. And after about 2.5 hours, I asked him a question. I said to this dear AA member, "What do you have in this rehabilitation program of yours for the wives and children of alcoholics?" And no one had ever asked him that before, I'm sure, because he couldn't answer. He said, "We don't have anything for the wives and children, Mrs. O'Neill. You do not have a problem." Dear God. At that moment, I could not wear sleeves on my arms because of a rash that the doctor said was caused by nerves. I was so nervous I couldn't stand in my own shoes. And that dear AA member said to me, "You do not have a problem." I thought he was wrong. I still think he was wrong. And I believe with all my heart that it was that cold November afternoon when I stood in the living room of a mean little rent house in Brownwood, Texas, where we wound up, that I made up my mind that someday, somehow, I would find a way to help the families of alcoholics. And by the grace of God, that opportunity came because then I met some more people. Now, these were non-alcoholic people, a weird bunch of people, who found it vitally necessary to practice the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous to preserve their sanity and to preserve their stability and to restore their sanity. And I knew these people. I was drawn to them. These people could make my life a little bit better just because they were there. And they could teach me how to live one day at a time. And I used to say they didn't have a name, but they had a lot of names, some of which I cannot repeat in polite society. The groups up here in Canada were called the Wives Groups, you may remember. But these people eventually came to be known as the Al-Anon Family Groups. And I went to my first Al-Anon Family Group meeting. Again, reluctantly, didn't want to go. Bill hired a man who had been in AA for about 10 years. In fact, he was Bill's cousin, and he'd been in AA for about 10 years out in California. He was a cohort of Chuck and Elsa Chamberlain and all those good people. And Bill hired him to work for him, and his wife was an Al-Anon member. And she tricked me into going to my first meeting. I had pneumonia for 8 consecutive years when I first went to Texas. I think I was trying to escape. Always in February. And I had been in bed. My hair was a mess. And well, you know how you are when you stay in bed for 3 months and the doctor won't let you get out of the house. And so a guy came over to my house one afternoon and volunteered to take care of the children so I could go to the hairdresser. She said, "It always made me feel better if I can go to the hairdresser when I've been in bed a long time." So I hurried off to the hairdresser to get my hair done. And when I came back, she said, "It sure would be a shame to waste that hairdo. Let's go to a meeting." Well, what are you going to do? She took care of my children, and I did feel better. So I went off to a meeting. Now, please remember, this was a long time ago. And so we went to the meeting, and they had a preamble in that group that incorporated the Constitution of the United States, the Bill of Rights, and the marriage ceremony. And they read this rigmarole. And that little Al-Anon from California, the little size 5 feet hit the floor, and she said, "What in the hell do you think you're doing?" And to say she turned that group around is an understatement. That was my first sponsor. A gray-eyed gal who was a psychologist. Had I known that, I wouldn't have stayed in the same room with her. And I didn't have the privilege of choosing a sponsor. We had meetings on Monday nights and Thursday nights. And I worked 52 hours a week at that time. Bill was very busy trying to get us out of debt. And I lived in a 12-room house that had to be past a white glove inspection when Bill came home on the weekends. So I was a pretty busy lady. And when Bill came home on the weekends, everything stopped except we looked after Dad. And Monday morning, that house looked, I heard a buffalo had gone through it, and I always didn't always get to that Monday night meeting because I had to put that house back in shape. And it was on one of these Monday night meetings that I was the only thing on the meeting agenda. And those seven, I think there was then at that time, eight including me, members sat down together to determine which one of them had the courage to be my sponsor. That gives you an idea how sick I was. And Guy volunteered for the job, and she came over to the house and told me she was my sponsor. And that didn't disturb me. I learned early on when I first went to Texas that it was extremely easy to shock those Southern Baptist people. And I had a ball. Now, the best way you can shock them is to tell them you don't believe in God. They'll just get plumb away from it. So Guy came over and told me she was my sponsor, and I wanted to get rid of her as quickly as I could because I had to get back to worrying. And so she said to me, "Have you come to terms with the first step?" And I said, "Well, certainly." And I repeated the step to her. I said, "Everybody's powerless over alcohol, Guy. It's a chemical." And I polished it off by saying, "I'm also powerless over strychnine and carbolic acid." And she let me get by with it. And I didn't have the privilege of making up my mind about when I would take the fourth step. She told me when to do it. And I got the distinct feeling that if I didn't take those blasted steps, she wasn't going to let me come up for air. And I took the steps with, again, the worst motive possible. Very worst kind of motive. I was going to take those blasted steps, slap that paper down in front of that gray-eyed sponsor of mine, and say to, I was going to get an A-plus up in the corner. I'd never seen anything else on my paper. I was going to slap that down in front of her and say, "I took these blasted steps and they didn't work." And they did. I don't like to tell all these things. It's a long time ago, of course, and it's really none of your business. I went to those first meetings because my children were afraid of me. Now, please don't misunderstand me. I'm not a child abuser. My children were afraid of my disapproval. If one of my children was in a school play, I had to watch it from the wings because if I sat out in the audience, they forgot their lines. I would not tolerate average work. Of course, I have had four very gifted children, and I explained to them that anybody could be average, but they had more potential than that. So my children were afraid of me. And my husband was ashamed of me. And I didn't want my children to be afraid of me. And I certainly didn't want Bill to be ashamed of me. So that was the reason that I worked those blasted steps. And of course, the first thing that I noticed was that the children could relax around me. They finally got so relaxed, they sassed me. That took a lot of nerve. And then gradually, very gradually, I became aware of the fact that, once again, Bill was proud of me. And that's very important to those of us who love alcoholics. This sick need for approval is a very real thing. And you know, we'll do anything, as Roger said earlier today, we'll do anything to get their approval. And we don't need very much. Now think with me just a moment. An alcoholic is just about as low down on the social totem pole as you could get, wouldn't you say? They're sorry, no account, dirty people that never work and abuse their families. Everybody knows that. They're just about as low down on the social totem pole as you could get. And then they reject us. So this is a real thing, this need for approval. Sick to be, you bet. But it's a real thing. And I was very grateful when I was aware of the fact that once again Bill was proud of me. And I made friends. At first, of course, right in my own little group. And some of you told me that you liked me. And then I could belong to the human race. I started out as a group representative. I was the only delegate that Texas ever had. After my panel, they divide the state into two assembly areas. It took two people to do the job that I had done. And I never let them forget it. Never let them forget it. I was 10 years in the program when I served as a delegate from Texas, and when I was 20 years in the program, I was privileged to serve on your board of trustees. I was privileged to get to know Lois and Bill. I hope I'm never guilty of saying I was an intimate friend of Lois Wilson, because that was not true. I had tremendous respect for her. I was not afraid of her. She was too little to be frightening. But I had tremendous respect for her, and I so appreciate the over 6 years that I was privileged to work with her in our structure. Bill Wilson started our service conferences, same as he started the AAs, and corrected a mistake he made in your structure. Your delegates served for 2 years, and we served for three because he felt that was best. Bill Wilson opened the first 9 conferences that we had. I was at the first 3 as a delegate, and I guess he died the first year that I was on the board. He died in 71, and I went on the board in 70. So I was privileged to have that opportunity, and I'm most grateful for it. And we took the principles of this program, Bill and I did, and reared those 4 children of ours. We never did hand them a big book and make them go through the steps like we do the Al-Anon and AA members, but they were exposed. Roger used the example this morning. They had the example of some solid AA people, and I'm grateful for that. I think it's a large mistake for this generation of Al-Anon people to forget from whence we came. When I came here back in the late 40s and early 50s, we didn't have any literature. Not any literature at all. We had to develop that literature. All we had in those early years was the 2 chapters in the book Alcoholics Anonymous that were intended for the families. And that's what we used. And we took a paragraph out of the chapter to the family afterwards and made of it a preamble that we used to open our meetings. And I'm sure all of you know what the paragraph says in the chapter to the family afterwards. The past is the principal asset of the alcoholic's family, the book says, and frequently it is almost the only one. This painful frequently it is almost the only one. Your painful past is the greatest possession you have, the key to life and happiness for others. With it you can avert death or misery for them. I left out one line, that line that says, we feel that each family which has been relieved owes something to those who have not, and when the occasion requires, each member of it should bring former mistakes, no matter how grievous, out of their hiding places. Showing others how we were given help is the only thing that makes our life worthwhile. Cling to the thought that in God's hands, your dark past is the greatest possession you have. With it, you can avert death or misery for them. And as far as I'm concerned, that's the basis of our fellowship. And I'm extremely grateful for the fact that I was exposed to some of the spiritual giants in the AA fellowship when I came here. I was scared to death. I was 1,700 miles from my home. I had expected to find a support group when I met Bill's family, and that did not happen. They readily understood why Bill stayed drunk all the time is because he was married to a Yankee from North Carolina, where they made all that bourbon liquor and made those filthy cigarettes that are killing people. They could understand that. And so I was absolutely helpless. Helpless and hopeless. And these dear people in AA could not help me as they helped the AA members. They wanted to, but they didn't have all the answers for me or all the solutions. We don't have answers. And so I said to them, I don't understand Bill. Bill hates a liar worse than he hates anything in the world, but he can't tell the truth. And I can't depend on him. He's irresponsible. And they handed me the book. And they said, read this, Arbutus. It will teach, it will explain the nature of the illness that Bill has. And it will teach you the philosophy that you will need for your recovery. Now tell me, if you can, what other reason you'd have for studying that book. It will explain the nature of the illness, and it will teach you the philosophy for your own recovery. And if you put it in a book, I believe it. If you print it and hand it to me, I believe it. And that's what I did. And that early literature that we developed was intended to be a supplement to that first 164 pages in the big book. And please don't misquote me, and you do sometimes. You say, Arbutus O'Neill said every Al-Anon member in the world ought to read the big book, and I did not say that, and I never will say that. I only say that the people I sponsor are required to study the first 164 pages of the big book or get themselves another sponsor. It makes no difference to me. But those spiritual giants was the people who started me on my road to recovery, little as it is. And I owe them a deep, deep grade of gratitude because they put the O'Neill family back together. They put the O'Neill family back together. And we took the principles of that program and reared those children. And there was a point in time, and I think Otto couldn't remember this, I don't think we were complacent where we are. We were just a happy bunch. We were able to make sure that those girls of ours got a college education. Teresa's only a few hours away from a doctorate's degree. She graduated magna cum laude from the university, and I said, that ain't bad for a drunk kid. Luther went into the Navy when he wasn't quite 18 years old and came back and started a little business with his dad's help. He had 25 men older than he was working for him, and I said, that ain't bad for a drunk's kid. And things were good. Things were good. This was a happy family. And then our children got mixed up with some other people's kids, and all hell broke loose. We married all four of them off. Three of them got divorces. I believe with all my heart the only reason that Les and Teresa are still married is because they're afraid to get a divorce, afraid I'll kill them. And then some time went by, and I started getting some telephone calls. I'd get a telephone call from Austin, and an AA member would say to me, you can go to sleep now, Arbutus. We followed Luther home, and he turned in his own driveway. And I'd get another call from the other side of Texas to tell me that Nancy had fallen in the ladies' room at the country club and cut her eye, but it was going to be all right. The floor was wet, you understand. Yeah. And that's when Otto paid me a large compliment. Nancy was married to a young psychiatrist who referred hundreds, literally hundreds of people to this program. And he was a classic enabler. I think he liked Nancy drunk. He'd sabotage her when she got a few months sobriety. And then when she got in AA and stayed sober, he couldn't handle that. And it was a pretty messy divorce. And Jack threatened Nancy with an institution. And we couldn't have prevented it. So she fled the country. She went to Mexico to live. And I don't speak Spanish. And so there was a large number of months when I couldn't communicate with my own child, because you can't get a telephone in Mexico just because you can pay the bill. You have to get on a list. And it took her a while to get a telephone. And I'd listened to AA ladies talk around the country, and I'd heard them describe how alcoholic women are exploited and the dreadful things that happen to them. And I'd heard about Mexican jails. And alcoholics have no defense against our imagination, absolutely no defense. And so in my imagination, I put Nancy on Skid Row. I could envision her in a Mexican jail and all those horrible things. And I like to went crazy. And that's when Otto said, "Yeah, we'll see what kind of a program Arbutus has." And it was rough. There was times that I couldn't get through the Serenity Prayer. I just could not. But I have a report to make to you. Nancy had 16 years sobriety, September 4. She's really doing a good job if she ever gets her leg out of a cast. She had she married a retired master sergeant next to a colonel. They're the smartest people in the military, I think. And they like motorcycles, and they had that gold wing thing that they were involved in, and they hit a deer down in South Texas, and Nancy got a couple of breaks, a spiral break in her left leg, and they didn't put a rod in her leg. They put some pins through it, and the operation didn't do what it was supposed to do, so she had to have it broken again and all that good stuff. She's still in the cast, but she's doing a good job. And when Luther breathed the last breath in his lifetime, March the 9th, he had just celebrated 16 years of sobriety. And I learned some things when they told us that our son was terminally ill. I learned that you didn't have to be brave every day. It was all right to kick and scream, and I do. I also learned that you can live with a sad situation and not be unhappy. He taught us really what one day at a time means, and I thought I knew, but he taught us. Don't let anyone ever tell you that the loss of your only son will get easier. It won't. There'll be an empty spot in your heart that will always be there. But thank God for this program. I don't know what people do that don't have our program. I just do not know how they survive. Bill has been housebound for almost 4 years now. And he's easy to take care of. He doesn't complain. Fortunately, Bill doesn't have any pain. He's just pitifully weak. He weighs 125 pounds, and he's almost 6 foot tall. I think he's 5'11". And it's kind of embarrassing to outweigh your husband. But when I told him when Luther got so desperately ill, I said, "Well, I think it's about time for me to hang up my spurs." And I had both those men on my back because they were so unhappy with me. Even my travel agent gave me a hard time. And I said, "Don't use that tone of voice when you speak to me, sir. I pay you money." But this program gives you... It's not comfortable. Don't let me mislead you. The pain is still there. The pain will never go away. I'm quite sure it will never go away. But because of this program, you have the tools to live in spite of. You know, we do a lot of things in spite of. And this program gives you that opportunity. I have three daughters. Very supportive females. And I get into serious trouble if I make a critical comment about their dad's behavior. I said recently, "Bill O'Neill has got to be the worst spoiled man I ever knew in my life." And my oldest daughter looked me square in the eye. She's one of those tall people, barely 5 foot tall. And her name is Peggy O'Neill. That's disgusting, but that's her name, not her nickname. And she looked me right in the eye and she says, "Who spoiled him?" So I have to take blame for everything that comes down the pike. I told him last week, I said, "I wish to goodness that you'd start eating like the doctor wants you to, because I'm tired as I can be of being head of the family." You know, that's a hard job. And now that we're having that repair work done on the house and I have to supervise 3 or 4 contractors, and if you're Harris White and you're female, they think you don't have a brain in your head. But they forgot that I grew up in a construction family and I know an 8-penny nail from a finishing nail. So they're going to have to stand some strong inspection before I write checks. And I'm rambling again. I try to remember to use the same closing every time I talk to you, and I'll do that now. I will remind you again that the principles of this program carries a message that the whole world needs to know. And you are the most uniquely qualified of anyone in the world to carry that message. And I'm quite sure that very likely within a stone's throw of this place we are, that there are drunken men and women who will die in total ignorance as did Stephen Foster if you fail to carry this message. And I'm quite sure that there's people in this pretty little town and down in Brownwood, Texas, everywhere that I know, there's people who will not have the courage to live one more day with an alcoholic, and they'll break up their homes if you fail to carry this message. And there's kids all over the world that never heard of Alateen, and these kids will grow up with a deformed personality if you fail to carry this message. And if you fail to carry this message, may God have mercy on us. May God have mercy on these people. And may God have mercy on us.